Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My guest this week is Ross Dunn, who has recently published a new edition of The Travels of Ibn Battuta, and whom we are going to discuss this week. And he's embarking on quite an incredible journey, and especially for the time that they live in. But of course, before we go to go into his journey, I want to know, how did you come about studying the Islamic world?
Right. It really started out with an interest in Africa, African studies, and African history. And I've always been asking myself how I got interested in that, because I come from a very rural part of the western side of New York State, hundreds of miles from New York City. And that was my upbringing. So my first interest in Africa was reading a novel about the Mau Mau Rebellion. And when I read that, I was like 16 or 17 years old. And I would have to say that the book is something of a racist potboiler, but I didn't really understand that at the time. Mm. And I was just fascinated by the African setting of this novel. It was called Something of Value. So when I went off to college, I was always interested in studying anything about Africa. And if I had to write an essay for a course, I would try to write something about Africa if I could. And there was no program in African history at the university I went to, which was the State University of New York at Albany. But I was a history major and a French minor, and I took many different history courses, none of them African history, because it simply wasn't available at the time. But I told my advisors I wanted to go to graduate school and study African history. And they thought that was a crazy idea, because they didn't think Africa was a field at all that was part of the academic universe. Well, this was a long time ago, of course. This was actually in the 1960s when I went off to college and graduate school. But I was determined, and so I got into the University of Wisconsin Graduate School, which had really one of the two or three finest African studies programs in the country at the time. So I began a study of African history. And that immediately led me into Islamic studies as well, naturally, because so many millions of Africans are Muslims. Part of my program in that studies, which was really African and Islamic studies together, I started a program in Arabic study, Arabic language. And in my second year of Arabic language study, by that time I'd already been introduced to Ibn Battuta. Before I went to graduate school, I didn't know who he was, but I learned who he was quickly, because if you study Africa or the Islamic world in general, you run across Ibn Battuta very soon. Oh. So in my Arabic language class, I decided but with my classmates, we determined that we'd like to translate parts of the travels of Ibn Battuta from Arabic into English, in the process of learning the language. Mm. So that's how I first got involved with Ibn Battuta's his own narrative in doing this this translation. So after graduate school, I got my degree in African and Islamic studies, and I got a job in at San Diego State University, and I taught there for about 6 years before I came to the idea of writing a book about Ibn Battuta. I was teaching African history, and I was teaching about him in the course, but I also was involved in starting a program in world history at the university, something that is not taught so much in Europe, but a great deal in the core curriculum or general education programs in the United States. World history is often a requirement. So we started a course at San Diego State University in world history. And teaching that for a couple of years, I thought, you know, Ibn Battuta illustrates something amazing about the history of the world, and that is the extraordinary extent of the Muslim world in his time, in the 14th century, and that the trouble with historical studies is that they have tended to divide the world up into, you know, separate regions, and never study them as if they're connected to one another. And that's, of course, the lesson of world history, that they are and were, since very early times, connected to one another and were interacting in various ways. And of course, Ibn Battuta was not not someone who limited himself to the— he was an Arabic speaker, but didn't limit himself to the Arabic speaking world, but traveled all the way across the Eastern Hemisphere and back again, passing through multiple societies, multiple civilizations.
He traveled more than back, just back again.
Sorry?
He traveled more than just back again. He even went to Al-Andalusia after his journey, and as we will come back to, of course, and he traveled to the world of Timbuktu as and the Mali Empire as well, among
that's
others.
Right. He came back home for a short time, and then he took off again, right, to Andalusia and to into West Africa. So I just got this idea, you know, it would be really interesting to write a book about Ibn Battuta. I wasn't discovering him. I mean, all Muslim scholars knew about him. Africanists all knew about him. And he was even coming into the textbooks in the United States in Islamic and African history. So I wasn't discovering some unknown person. He was already well known, but nobody had done what I wanted to do, and that was to write about him, not to write about his text so much. There were a lot of you know, philological studies of the text itself, but I wanted to write about the man, and his biography, but to set it in the context of this incredible cosmopolitan world of Islam, which spanned the hemisphere. I think I thought from the beginning that I'd like to write a book that could be made into a movie about Ibn Battuta.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
We can come back to that later, but he's a very much more interesting character than Marco Polo. Much more interesting.
And of course, we're going to discuss about him now, and I want to begin with, before we go into this, just because travel in the Islamic world wasn't uncommon, and he wasn't, of course, the only traveler. Ibn Khaldun as well is perhaps equally known traveler at this that time. But to travel in the Islamic world, as we spoke about in our episode on Al-Andalusia, you needed a receipt at least, or you needed a degree, as I believe he was a judge, that he was educated as, which made him available to travel. So let's talk about, first of all, what was required if you wanted to travel throughout the Islamic world.
Well, if we look at his particular case, he was a legal scholar, and his intention was to travel to make the Hajj, to make the holy pilgrimage in Mecca. That was his initial purpose in traveling. Now, broadly, people were traveling over long distances, especially merchants, across the Indian Ocean, across the Sahara Desert, and so on. Ibn Battuta was not a merchant. He was sometimes interested in mercantile questions, but he was not in that category. He was a scholar who wanted to get to Mecca. And the Quran enjoins Muslims to look out for travelers, for wayfarers, to show them hospitality, especially if they're going to Mecca. So as a pilgrim, he really had no trouble finding a bed and a meal wherever he went, simply because he was a wayfarer. It was that tradition of hospitality that was so remarkable throughout the Muslim world.
I wanted to do a comparison, if you don't mind. Was this common in the Christian world as well, or was this unique for the Islamic world, the hospitality at the time?
I don't think it's unique. I think it probably operated in the Christian world as well. Travelers staying in commercial way stations or in monasteries or churches where they would be able to get a place to lie down and get a meal. It probably would not be terribly hard, but I think in the Muslim world it was quite specifically enjoined by the faith that wayfarers should be treated hospitably. So it was very important to do that, and I've been treated to that kind of hospitality many times myself in traveling in the Muslim world. You know, it's just expected that you're going to stay for dinner, as it were.
So let's talk about his Hajj and his continue on his Hajj and his travel to Mecca, because I don't remember exactly where, but it does meet a prophet that he is rather inspired by, that tells him a fortune, that he will meet many friends and meet many of them again on his travel, that he will travel not just in Mecca, but he will travel further than he ever imagined.
Right.
So doesn't he meet his fortune teller, the fortune teller that he meet on the journey, I believe.
Oh, right. That's a story that he tells about meeting a man in Egypt who predicted that he would make these travels, and I never gave much attention to that story, because I think it was something that Ibn Battuta, there's probably some truth to his meeting someone who made these predictions, but I think it's a literary trope, really, that idea.
Kind of like with what Caesar, to go into a comparison, kind of what Caesar told about the story about the pirates is kind of to make it something, exciting on the journey, right? Just to make it a little bit how he did, to give it a little bit of excitement.
Yeah, I think probably so.
But he does make it to Mecca eventually.
It's a hard journey for him to get there, because he goes up the Nile Valley, planning to cross the Red Sea directly to the area of Mecca, from Egypt to Arabia, and there's a war going on in that region when he gets to the port on the Egyptian side, and he can't get a ship across, so he goes all the way back down to Cairo. and goes across the Sinai Peninsula to Damascus and Jerusalem, and finally, in the following year, he joins a caravan from Damascus to get to Mecca.
Now, I will first just for a second, because let's talk about the distances, because as we talked about, it will travel all the way to China as well. But let's talk about the distance for a second, because it is quite, even from where it begins to where to Mecca is quite a distance. And it's not just like we do today. It wasn't just to take an airplane and you're there in 2 hours. It took days, if not weeks, to travel, or months to travel this
For
distance.
years, yeah. Yeah, it took a long time to get anywhere. And of course, he traveled probably in every conceivable way at the time, by horseback and mule and wagon train, but also and camel, riding camel. But he also traveled by sea part of the time. So,
Was it dangerous to travel to sea considering the piracy, or was it the sa was that the more safer journey at the time?
well, his experience shows us that the traveling was never safe for anybody, because he was accosted a number of times, and he was actually a ship he was on in the Indian Ocean was attacked and boarded by pirates off the southern coast of India. And he tells us that that happened. And they stripped everybody pretty much of their belongings and even their clothing, but they didn't kill anybody. They just let everybody off and to go on shore. So Ibn Battuta, after being robbed by these pirates, he gets on shore in India, but all he's got on is his pants and shirt, and they stole everything else that he had. So he had to start over again. So yeah, it was. Travel was hazardous, and you wanted to travel in a company of others. When he started out from Tangier, left home, he was all by himself. At least that's what he says, which I would think would be very dangerous. He soon, by the time he gets to Western Algeria, city of Tlemcen, he meets up with other travelers and he joins them, which was the thing you should have done from the start. It would be better to travel in a group, and even with a military escort, if you can get one.
So instead of what finally makes it back, he doesn't decide to go home. What makes him continue the journey to eat further east? What excites him so much about continuing the travel from Mecca and not go home, considering he made the pilgrimage, he'd done his duty to the Islamic tradition? Why doesn't he choose to go home, as he probably originally was thinking about?
That's a great question. It's one I've been always struggling with, and I still don't have a convincing answer as to why he did that. After he performed the Hajj in Mecca and visited Medina, he decided to travel to Baghdad, and then went on up through Iraq and part of Iran, and then back to Mecca again. And he never really explains to his reader why he made that trip, why he didn't just, after he made one pilgrimage, go back home again. I think part of it was that he was thinking about undertaking more study, legal study, which he had done already in Damascus and maybe somewhat in Jerusalem and in Mecca. But I think, and I should also add that he was a Sufi practitioner, and there was a great interest in on his part and merit in seeking out and meeting up with Sufi sheikhs, with Sufi holy people who had accumulated heavy concentration of what they call baraka. Baraka meaning blessing. You know, Barack Obama, as we call him. That's this fundamentally the same word, Barak. Baraka meaning blessing in Arabic. So to receive the blessings of Sufi masters was one of his motivations for travel as well. But I think underlying it all was he was learning that in the Muslim world, especially the outer reaches of the Muslim world, the areas that had more recently been conquered by Muslims, or Muslim society was taking root, that there was a lot of career opportunities for people like him there. Because he was an Arabic speaker, he belonged to what they would call the race of the Prophet, being an Arab. You know, he wasn't an Arab really. His family were all Berber descent, but he was culturally he was an Arabic speaking gentleman. And whether he knew any of his ancestral Berber languages, I don't know. But I think that he's looking for, probably very early on in his travels, career possibilities, and maybe recognizing that rather than go home, he might find greater career possibilities as a legal scholar, or as some kind of an official, mosque official or official in government, by venturing to the newer areas of Islam.
And as we will talk about, of course, it does come in handy having a little education, because it does serve as several course in not just in the Muslim world, but in India as well, to the Indian Sultan, among others. And it does, as we will talk about, as I'm sure he does, but get sent by the Sultan to of India to China as the envoy as well. So he does. It does come in handy having the education that it has.
Yeah, the Sultan of India was a case of someone who was very interesting, and you know, the sultans of India, their ancestors had not been Muslims for very many generations, so they're really those families were had converted to Islam. And in India, of course, the bulk of the population were not Muslims at all. They were Hindu. But there was a desire on the part of rulers like the one in India, Muhammad ibn Tughluq, to surround themselves with Muslim scholars, with Muslim religious officials, with all Muslims who would lend an aura of legitimacy to their court, legitimacy as pious Muslim rulers. So to do that, you have to create Muslim institutions, colleges, universities, Muslim mausoleums for the burial of rulers. And these are all institutions that support Muslim society. And, you know, that's where he found his opportunity, of course, especially in India. You know, before he went to India, he went to East Africa, you know, south of the equator, as far as what is today Tanzania. And he never says why he made that trip. We really don't know. But my suspicion was that he was looking for work, and I think he just didn't find what he was looking for, so he decided to go back. And we know he was already thinking about going to India, but it took him just longer to get there than he had planned.
So something that he does mention several times in his text is, of course, that when he was little judge for the sultan's court or whatever court he visited, was that he usually would get gifts, rich gifts from these rulers, and he was quite proud of this, that he got so many gifts, and he got so get all these, jewels and precious stuff that is, and he seems to be quite proud of that he gets all his gifts because he does serve. He seemed to be quite important figure for the court.
Yeah, that's right. He's it's in Turkey, traveling through Turkey or what was then Anatolia, that he first began to make a good living. And that was just because he had prestige as an Arabic speaking alim meaning a legal scholar, the literate educated class. And he found that he was treated with great privilege just because of his status as a member of the ulama class, the learned class. So he visits a number of different princely courts in Anatolia, Turkish speaking rulers. And everywhere he goes, he's treated very well. He's, as you said, he's given many, many gifts. Those gifts include enslaved women and enslaved boys. I don't know how to, what quite to make of that, but so when
Doesn't he
he
end up getting married as well on the journey?
he was married several times and he had several children, and I've often remarked to my students that Ibn Battuta finally returned home, and he could sit at home back in Morocco and think about all his children growing up across the Eastern Hemisphere, of which there were several, but he left them all behind, left
There
them
is
with their.
this story I remember, but I don't exactly remember where. But he does take the ship, and there's I think his wife is on board another ship or something. But he gets separated from her and his son, and he never get to see them again. I don't remember exactly where this is, but there is this story where there's this disastrous storm, and he does, he gets separated from them, never sees them again.
Yeah, that was off the Malabar coast in southwestern India when he's was supposed to be going on this mission for the Sultan to China, which comes to an end right there because of this storm, which the ships are either destroyed or they simply sail away. It wasn't a wife. It was a concubine, a slave girl who or probably two or three of them and he was supposed to be on the ship, but he was still on shore making arrangements for the accommodation of his slave girls. And he didn't go back to Delhi after that because the mission had failed. And I can imagine that if he'd gone back to Delhi and the Sultan interviewed him about what happened to the mission, he would find it hard, and the Sultan would ask him, "Well, why weren't you on the ship that went down, or that sailed away?" And I don't think he wanted to have to tell the Sultan that he was on shore making arrangements for his the bedrooms for his slave girls. That's why he survived, probably.
Now, let's talk about his time in India for a second, because his description of the Sultan is that he was kind of a cruel man, and he could be courteous as well, but when he was cruel, he was really cruel, and that's one of the reasons he was scared of going back after losing his wife, because he was scared he would execute him if he found out that his treasures. He was supposed, as we talked about, as an envoy to China, that he was going to give to the queen, to the leader emperor there.
Yeah, right. So, the Sultan Ibn Muhammad ibn Tughluq was a fascinating character way. And we know as much as we do about him just because of Ibn Battuta. There are some other writings that talk about him. But Ibn Battuta has this extensive portrait of the Sultan, and that he could be extraordinarily generous with people. Ibn Battuta talks about his procession going through the city, and his soldiers tossing gold coins out to the people. That's one of the stories that he tells back home. And one person who does write about Ibn Battuta back home, he couldn't. He said, "Oh, that's nonsense that the soldiers would be throwing money to the people." But I find it very plausible that he did that. So he could be very generous to people. He was generous to Ibn Battuta. Ibn Battuta accumulated a lot of debt, and he asked the Sultan to pay his debts, which the Sultan did. Of course, then he lost favor with the Sultan because he was discovered to have been in the company with an enemy of the Sultan, or a man he perceived to be an enemy. And so he was kept captive in the palace for a while, and thought he was going to be executed, but he wasn't. Yeah, but the Sultan was a he really is coming near the end of the Delhi Sultanate. It lasts some what longer until the coming of the Mughals.
So yeah, he did fell out of favor, but how does he get sent an envoy from to China, considering if did as I spoke about if it did fell out of favor to the Sultan?
Well, he never tells us why he in particular was chosen. I guess the Sultan decided that he was not terribly culpable of any crime, and just because he had associated with someone the Sultan didn't like, and so he was let go, and he went into a sort of spiritual retreat for a while, Ibn Battuta did. And then the Sultan called him back and appointed him to this mission. But why he was picked, we don't have much of an idea. Probably Ibn Battuta ballooned his own importance to some extent in Delhi, although he also gives us clues himself that he wasn't a terribly important person. He was one legal scholar, one judge among many, and he was insofar he was an expert at all. And Ibn Battuta was not a great legal scholar. We know he wasn't because we have no evidence that he spent much time, mastering the numerous memorizing, indeed numerous legal texts that would make you a prestigious scholar. But he got this job as a judge, partly because of the prestige he simply embodied for being an Arab, and from being from the central lands of Islam, and having and being a member of a particular class of legal scholars. So he gets this job, and but he was insofar he was as he was a legal scholar, he was a scholar in the Maliki. There are four major schools of law, right? And he was an authority in the Maliki school, which was not practiced in India. The Hanafi school was more prominent, and the administration was conducted in Farsi, in Persian language. Which was, in addition to Arabic, the major literary and scholarly language in Islam. I mean, he didn't. He claims to have learned some Persian, but I don't think he spoke Persian fluently. So he was not really highly qualified to be a Hanafi judge in a Persian-speaking administrative world. And he says that he was able to hire what he calls substitutes, which were like paralegals, I guess, or you know, clerks, legal clerks who do the work. And probably took care of most of the legal business on his behalf. And we don't have very many examples of cases that he prosecuted, a few. He had more power as a judge, really, I think, eventually when he went to the Maldives Islands, because in the Maldives Islands, he also gets a job as a judge. But in Delhi, he's not a terribly important person. So why he should be picked for this mission to China, that's remains something of a mystery.
Now, I want to talk about sources of Ibn Battuta, because, you know, as we mentioned, we do have his own account of his travels in his life. But do we have any outside sources where he is mentioned that can confirm what he is talking about is in his travels and mentioned Ibn Battuta? I mean, he's kind of an important person right now, but was he really at the time worthy of being mentioned in historical sources, or was he doing mainly just have his own account to account write to get draw from his life from?
Right, you know, that's always a good question. The independent sources on his existence are very, very limited. One of them is serendipitous. It's really lucky that we have it, and that is, it appears in Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddima, his master's work. Ibn Khaldun was in Fez for a considerable period of time in Morocco, and he writes almost kind of just coincidentally in his book, the Muqaddimah, that when he was in Fez, you know, this guy shows up named Ibn Battuta, and he claims to have been to India and all these places abroad. And Ibn Khaldun says, you know, some people don't believe him. They think he's a liar. But Ibn Khaldun says, well, you know, you need to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. You know, maybe he did go to all of these places. And it's just one paragraph, and it doesn't tell us much about Ibn Battuta, but it tells us that he existed, that he wasn't sitting home all those years making all of this up. And there's other ways that I think we can vouch for the reliability of what he says, not just that, but Ibn Khaldun at least shows that he really, there was somebody named Ibn Battuta. And then there is a set of biographies. It's a type of literature in Islam, of a compilation of biographies of notable people, like who's who in America or who's who in the Netherlands. there's an article about him there that describes, again, it's just very briefly describing that he made these travels and claims to have been to India and came back again. And
do you have any sources in India that mentions his stay there?
No, there are none. I mean, none that have ever been recovered, and you know, that goes for most of the places that he traveled. Although, another writer on Ibn Battuta, maybe you've seen his books as well, Tim McIntosh Smith. He's written three volumes on Ibn Battuta, Tim McIntosh Smith was a travel writer and a really serious Arabist, highly fluent in reading and writing and speaking Arabic, much more than I ever came to be. And Tim, in working with a scholar in Morocco who had an interest in Ibn Battuta, who's now gone, they discovered that a manuscript turned up in Morocco, if I recall, that appears to have been translated by Ibn Battuta when he was in Damascus, which shows that he did do some studies while he was there. And we know it because Ibn Battuta's signature is on this document as a translator of it. There's also a letter that has been discovered by a Muslim scholar who was in Andalusia and Morocco. That's just a sort of ordinary document of a sale of property that involved a sale of property to Ibn Battuta. So we don't learn much about him from these things, but they do tell us that he probably wasn't making everything up.
So do forgive me for going a little bit back and forth, but let's go back to after when he lost his concubine, not wife, as you corrected. So yeah. According to him, it does decide anyway, regardless, because he's too scared to go back to the Sultan after he lost his precious and gifts to the Emperor of China. So why does he choose to embark on the journey to China? And anyway, and because it does seem, according to himself, go on the journey to China.
Well, he goes to the Maldive Islands first, and he's there for several months, and that's a fascinating story in itself because he gets involved in a plot to overthrow the queen of the Maldive Islands, which doesn't come to anything. But he never tells us very clearly why he decided to continue on to China. And, you know, there is a good deal of controversy about whether he actually did visit China and how much of China he saw. So, you know, we can get into that if you want.
Yes, but, please. I mean, please do.
When I was writing my book, I was really undecided, ambivalent about how to treat it because of the, you know, the criticism that he never really did get to China. I came to the conclusion that he probably did, may well have anyway, reached the southern coast of China. And in my own book, it's in the footnotes of my book, but I wrote quite extensively about this issue. He claims to have gone all the way to Beijing and attended the funeral of the Mongol Khan, the great Khan of China. But I think that is nonsense. I don't think he ever, I mean, he wouldn't have had time in terms of the time scale that he gives us, the chronology that he gives us. And we know that no Mongol ruler died during the period he says he went to his funeral. His description.
And again, if I may, when we look at the distance and all the mountains he had to pass, because it's quite a mountainous area getting from India to China as well, it's takes quite a while to. It wasn't tunnels or anything, I'm not sure there is today, but you know, he had to climb quite a lot of mountains as well. And you know, the terrain, there weren't as good roads as we have today as well. I don't know the road system there today. Again, I don't know if the road system is good, if it's good today, but you know, it was quite different roads and the area, and it was quite different from what you see today, I imagine. And of course, I have to mention the mountains he had to climb as well Probably so. The distance again, it comes up. It's quite still, even on a large distance from Delhi to China, even the borders of China.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly true, but he was he traveled by sea, and traveling by sea between India and China was become routine by the 14th century. I mean, really, even much earlier than that. So there are ships going back and forth all the time.
Right, I didn't think about the sea, of
Chinese,
course.
there were big Chinese vessels in the ports of southern India that he describes, you know, how big they were and so on. So getting there from the coast of India to China w was not much of a problem. But getting from the ports of southern China all the way to Beijing, you know, that's another matter altogether, which you would normally do overland. I mean, China had probably the best transport system anywhere in the world at that time. I'm sure they did, in terms of roads and canals, traveling by canal, the Great Canal that connected northern China with southern China. So he could have done it, but there's no way he could have done it in the time that he allots for having done it. Even on the southern coast of China, there's he describes seeing a particular mosque in I forget which city, Guangzhou, or I forget which city it was in. And one scholar has determined that that mosque had burned down some years before Ibn Battuta arrived in China. So, you know, that's suspicious. His whole description of China is very short and you know, and quite vague. I think he didn't stay very long. He describes China. He didn't like it. He didn't like being there very much because the population was not, there weren't very many Muslims to hang out with, and you know, the population ate pork all the time and had a lot of habits he didn't like. So he didn't really want to stay there very long. I can understand that. So, I've given him the benefit of the doubt in taking him to a couple of ports on the South China coast, but the rest of these travels in China, I sincerely doubt. Now, you may not have to blame Ibn Battuta for lying to us. It's also a possibility that after he came home, and after the Rihla was the travel book was written, that other authors took it and added to it. They could have done that. And, you know, saying, well, if Ibn Battuta did not go to China, he should have. And so let's put something in there about Ibn Battuta in China. We think that that actually is the case. He claims also to have traveled up the Volga River deep into the heart of Russia. And most scholars agree that he probably didn't do that. And I can his description is faulty and it's extremely vague and doesn't make much sense. And he wouldn't have had time to do it. But I think you have to understand that he was writing that he's not the actual author of the book. He worked with this young Andalusian scholar named Ibn Juzay, who had the literary credentials to do this sort of thing, which Ibn Battuta was not trained that way. So they worked together to write the Rihla. You know, Marco Polo, it was the same. He had a guy named Rustichello, who actually was doing the putting together the manuscript for Marco Polo. So I can imagine Ibn Battuta and Ibn Juzay sitting together and talking about the travels, and Ibn Battuta saying, "Well, you know, I would like to have gone up the Volga because there was a Muslim community called Bulgar, a region up the Volga River, where there were a lot of Muslims living merchants, probably mostly. But I didn't have time to go there." And his Ibn Juzay might have said, "Well, you should have gone there. I mean, that's part of the Muslim world." So, you know, let's write something in about that. Maybe he didn't even tell Ibn Battuta he was doing it, because you have to understand this book was a kind of It was kind of a travel account of the Muslim world of the 14th century. And it was supposed to be comprehensive and include all parts of the Muslim world. So I think there may have been a couple of places that Ibn Battuta says he went that he didn't go, but they're included because they Ibn Juzay thought they should be. You see what I mean?
So let's talk about this journey home, because what I haven't mentioned is I believe his journey altogether from his home to the coast of China, as we discussed right now, it took around 35 years. Is that right? So let's talk about this journey home.
29 years altogether, this
Yeah.
whole,
But firstly, let's just talk about his journey home from Asia and back to the Muslim world.
And he did it pretty fast. He claims that he took a ship back to southern India and then caught another ship from there to trying to think where I have to look at my own book to remember where he got off the ship at a Persian port or in Arabia. But anyway, he sailed back to the Persian Gulf, Arabia area from India, and then went back up to Damascus and then quickly to Mecca again and through Cairo. And now he traveled on land all the way from Morocco to Egypt, but on the way back, he traveled part of the way by ship, actually on a Genoese ship, and so it didn't take so as long. So he was traveling a lot of the time by vessel, going back home, and he seemed to want to get there as soon as he could, and in a way, it's surprising that he made it at all because he went right through Syria and Arabia when they were in Egypt, when they were experiencing the Black Death. His mother died of plague. So, but he just waltzed right through the Middle East and didn't get sick, apparently. He, or at least he survived the Black Death. Sometimes people did, but he never describes himself as getting those symptoms. So he made it home fairly quickly. But then once he got home, he decided to go to Andalusia, and his initial intention in going there was to help fight the jihad, the holy war against the Spanish who were assaulting the remaining Muslim cities on the southern coast of India, particularly Gibraltar. And he didn't actually get into any fighting, but he went on to Granada, and that's where he met Ibn Juzay. Then he came back to Morocco. After that, it was kind of a short trip and not very far. I mean, he just had to cross the Strait of Gibraltar, which is a simple matter. But then he decided to go to Mali, and again, he never tells us exactly why he wanted to do that. But I think he was looking for, a prestigious position again. Or some have argued that he was a spy for the Sultan of Morocco, who sent him there to accumulate information and bring it back. He never tells us, but he could be.
So something fascinating about his trip to Mali is that he is so used at this point that he receives, like we spoke about, he receives several gifts from several courts that he has worked in. But when it comes to the court of Mali, he's rather insulted by the ruler there, because he doesn't even receive him at first. He has to wait several days and he doesn't get gifts at all. He ha at the In the end, he goes and he complains to the, I believe it, I'm not sure the title, I believe it's Sultan of Mali, that he does to complain that he, you, I have, wherever I've been, I've gotten gifts from the rulers that I've served with, and you haven't given me anything, and I've been here, I haven't even met you. I had to wait for several days before receiving you.
Right, yeah, and then when they bring him a meal, it's a bowl of oatmeal, something like that.
I mean, that's perhaps one of the most, to me, it's one of the perhaps most fascinating parts of the journey, because you know he is so you because it's such a fascinating story to me.
Yeah, it certainly is, and I think he was a pretty straight-laced Muslim scholar of the Maliki school, and he thought that since Islam had been introduced to West Africa from Morocco, that the people of Mali should be upholding the proper standards of behavior and moral behavior. And he's women are walking around naked, partially naked, and women are hanging out with men and sitting around with them and talking who aren't their wives and so on. And I think he wants to tell his audience when he writes the book later on, that I'm a proper Muslim scholar who understands the Morocco's urban standards of behavior. And so naturally, I'm incensed that these people in Mali were not doing that. I think he wants to show his readers that he's different from them in that respect. His not being treated terribly well, I think maybe part of the reason was that there were a lot of Moroccan scholars who were going to Mali, Moroccan merchants, of course, and scholars as well, who were going back and forth between Morocco and Mali. So he may not have stood out as anybody terribly special.
You mentioned something about the Delhi Sultan a while ago, and I want to bring this up again now that I'm speaking about the Mali Empire. And I'm sure you know what I'm going to talk about because, you know, when you mentioned that he threw gold coins at the street to people that the Sultan of Delhi, it reminded me of Mansa Musa on his travel to Mecca, how he broke down the economic system and he threw gold coins everywhere. And it kind of reminded me of his journey on the Hajj from Mali, in a sense.
Right. Yeah,
So,
well,
you know how people didn't believe him, but then later, or and don't remember except the date for Mansa Musa, but you know, it's kind of a similar story there, how they didn't believe him, but you know, as Mansa Musa will do almost exactly the same as what the Sultan of Delhi did.
I know that Mansa Musa did distribute a lot of money, a lot of gold. And there's a highly reputable Muslim geographer named Al-Umari, who wrote extensively about it's one of the main sources of Mansa Musa's travels. And he talks about how the merchants and the bankers were upset because the price of gold fell through the floor in Cairo because Mansa Musa was distributing so much of it.
So, but
It was a
in
major
all,
source. The gold fields in West Africa were a major source of gold for the whole of Afro-Eurasia, really. I don't know how much of it ever reached China, probably not much, but certainly India.
but something that is fascinating. I may not fascinating is right word, but so he doesn't even Batuta doesn't seem to be too impressed with the Mali. It is a counter with the Mali Empire.
Yeah, well, he has a little summary, in his book about the Mali Empire, and he has a number of very nice things to say about the people, and he says that that they are many of them are properly pious, but then there are other things that he doesn't like, and that is women not covering their breasts and not being veiled, and what he thought were sort of crazy ceremonies, like people having to prostrate themselves on the ground and cover their heads with dust in the presence of the Sultan. And I think it comes back to the fact that he felt that the people of Mali should have been upholding Muslim standards in ways that they were not. But it's important to understand that the great majority of people in West Africa at that time were not Muslims. It was mainly a minority class of merchants and the rulers and their royal courts and their officials and scholars. They made up the Muslim population of West Africa at that time. They're really like in India, the great majority were Hindu in West Africa. They practiced local polytheistic or animistic religions.
So, well, how long does he stay in the Mali Empire? Because he does leave eventually and go back, as this is, I believe, his final journey that he'll partake. So, what makes it, when does it leave? How long does he stay and when does he need to go back again?
That's the kind of thing I don't hold in my mind very well after having written the book a long time ago. Do I have a glossary? You know, he was there only about a year or so. He wasn't very long, maybe less than that. To get the exact chronology, I'd have to look it up. But we're talking early 1350s.
So, of course, I think we're going to round it up there, and this, as we established, his journey is quite incredible. So, but what would you say is, and before going to his legacy, I want to ask about how important is Ibn Battuta as a source, and how can we really rely much? I think we are talking about some of this today, but can we rely much on what he says, and how important is he as a source in understanding the Islamic world at this point in the 14th century?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I think he's immensely important. It's not just because he was that he writes about parts of the world that other Muslim scholars wrote about, but that he was an eyewitness, that he's talking about his own experience. Like Al-Umari has written, as I mentioned him, one who wrote extensively about the 14th century Muslim world, including Mali, but he never went there. Ibn Battuta went there. And his description of Mali at that time is the only eyewitness account that we have. The same is true for his time in India. We have other sources, and Al-Biruni is one who was just a little bit later in time, and he was in India. But for the court of Ibn Tughluq, Ibn Battuta is the only really eyewitness, extensive description we have of that really important period of Indian history. And we can say the same for, you know, other places that he visited as well. The Maldive Islands, especially. Not that that's a terribly big place, but fascinating nonetheless. Because they had converted to Islam, the whole island archipelago. So he's important for his descriptions of places and peoples that for which we do have, you know, other sources, and the fact that we do helps us believe that Ibn Battuta's accounts were quite accurate. For example, he'll describe years and years after he'd been to a city, say a city in Syria or Iran somewhere, and he'll report the name of who was the governor of that city at the time. We have from independent sources that, yeah, that guy was the governor of that city at that time. So there are that corroborate what Ibn Battuta said.
And again, as we discussed before, the amount of miles that he covers in his life in the amount of 35 years, granted 39, but still is quite far going from Morocco to the coast of China. It's even though he did some by boat, it's still a long freaking way to travel, it's especially for the 14th century.
But he when he visited China, or claims to have visited China, I'm assuming that he did in the South Coast, he met a man there who was from Morocco. So in a way, Ibn Battuta's the extent of his travels may not have been all that extraordinary, but he wrote a book about it, right? And if you didn't write a book about it, it would never have been reported. In the Abbasid period, back in the 8th and 9th centuries, Muslim merchants were traveling all the way from the Persian Gulf to the Chinese coast and back again on the monsoons in a 2-year period.
And also the other way around to Al-Andalusia, which is quite far as well from Baghdad to Al-Andalusia to exchange scholarly papers and to learn from each other. So it's quite far distances, both from Baghdad to Al-Andalusia and to China. It's, maybe China's of course further, but still it's quite a far distance.
And Ibn Battuta met several people in India who were from India, who were from Egypt, or even North Africa. So it was an age in which people were on the move, and it was a as I've written, it was the second quarter of the 14th century. It was a pretty good time to travel, partly because the Mongol states were still intact most of that time. And the Delhi Sultanate, the Moroccan Sultanate, that these were reasonably stable places at the time. The Mongols were still ruling China. And then he comes back home in the middle of the century, in the mid-century. And after that, if you don't mind my language, the shit hits the fan, as they say in English, and all hell breaks loose across the hemisphere, starting with the Black Death, and in the wake of that, the collapse of several different regimes across the hemisphere. So he traveled at the right time, when I think it was sort of the twilight of the Mongol era of stability. And that was gone. I don't think if he'd been born a generation later, he would have traveled that much. Of course, Ibn Khaldun traveled during the second half of the 14th century, but he didn't go nearly as far. He didn't go further east than Iraq or Syria, maybe even Syria.
And Ibn Khaldun is, of course, an episode of itself, but it's especially what I find fascinating about him, to derail a little bit from Ibn Battuta, is his description when he got the Kiev Rus of the Vikings, who were not yet Eastern
Oh, wait,
Orthodox at the
description.
time. When Ibn Khaldun travels to, Kiev Rus at this time, and he meets a Viking, and it describes the Viking burial ritual. It's one of the most fascinating aspects
You
of
mean
Ibn.
Ibn Fadlan? You mean Ibn Fadlan?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Not Ibn Khaldun, yeah.
No,
Yeah.
I mess up sometimes, do forgive me.
Yeah, Ibn Fadlan, yeah, he just how far north he went, I'm not sure we know, but yeah, he.
So we do have a lot of these accounts of travelers, so it wasn't really that unique, if you will, as we spoke about in that sense, was it?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Ibn Battuta wasn't really, as we spoke about, without all these travelers at the time, and so it wasn't really that unique, but as you mentioned, he did write a book about it, which is what made him famous. But how many people actually, like you mentioned, we do have Ibn Khaldun among others, but how many actually was able to did to write about the travels from
Yeah.
when like Ibn Battuta did?
And I certainly don't want to understate his travels, because he He not only went east and west, he also went north and south. I mean, he south of the equator and north into inner Eurasia, what is, Ukraine and Russia. And, it's still really highly remarkable what he did. And it's hard to know, what other travelers there may have been who undertook similar itineraries, but I can't think there'd be very many who traveled as much as he did. But we don't know because they didn't write books.
So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on. I think we're gonna round it up there. Before I go, of course, where can people buy your books? Do you have anything else you want to promote? Anything you're working on that you're gonna release soon, or social media where people might find you?
Well, I'd love to. You wrote down this the copy of my book with the called The Adventures of Ibn Battuta, published by the University of California Press, and it's in the third edition. And if I get time, I'll do another edition and update it a bit more. I've been I've been involved in three or four potential film projects about Ibn Battuta. And in fact, about 15 years ago now or more that I made three trips to Morocco as a consultant on a plan to do a feature film about him. And but they never could come up with all the money that they would need to do it. The King of Morocco's one of his organizations provided seed money so that we could have these meetings and talk about it. Some scripts were generated, but it never came to pass. And
It's quite a shame because he is such a fascinating character that deserves a movie's journey. Is so interesting that it would be made. It would make a great historical movie.
Yeah, that's right. And as I say, he's Marco Polo is really quite a boring person. I mean, Marco Polo doesn't say much about himself and his life, whereas Ibn Battuta talks about his wives and his slave girls and who he likes and who he doesn't like and all these things that happened to him personally that is absent from Marco Polo's account. And yet we've got what 15 movies about Marco Polo. But that's because he's a Westerner, and it's still quite hard to get movies made about Muslims anywhere near Hollywood that don't involve terrorists.
I mean,
It's
there's a few characters that come to mind. I mean, Saladin would be make one epic future, for example, among others, who arguably would make a great Hollywood movie, I think.
yeah. I would like to see it as a TV series, in like 12 parts because his travels were so complicated and so complex. And when I was working on this project to develop a film, it was a real problem because they were just leaving out whole areas of his travels because they wanted to produce a 2.5 hour movie. And what kind of movie you would produce is also a question. Do you make Ibn Battuta into an action hero? Do you make him into a sort of an icon of this of Islam? And I wouldn't have done it either way. I make him a real human being who has flaws and foibles and things he shouldn't have done. It's like getting involved in a plot to overthrow a government and I'd love to see a movie that highlights those kinds of things, to really show the kind of man he was. I mean, he's probably a very interesting individual, a raconteur, but I don't know. He was a very human being, and he presents himself in a way that you really feel like you learn a lot about him. Whereas Marco Polo, you don't really know anything.
Again, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you. This has been With That Aged Well. We are available on Instagram. You can find us on Instagram. under Without Age 12 and Twitter under Without Age 12. We are available on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on iTunes, please consider writing a review. That will help us out a lot. And if you like this episode, please make sure to check out some other episodes that we have. You might like some of the ones we have made so far. Please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.